Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Much has been written about the fraying of our democratic institutions and the degradation of our political dialogue. Some blame our country's hyper-focus on tech and pop culture. Others, a digital world full of misinformation and lies. And still others, an education system that gives a shallow understanding of how our government is supposed to work. Our guest today might point to all these and more, but they also say there's hope, and it starts with social studies teachers. We're sitting down with two longtime educators who say these teachers, armed with stronger, more comprehensive history course materials, can actually help cure democratic dysfunction. We find out more this hour on The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Elizabeth DeBrule, Director of Education for the New Hampshire Historical Society. She oversaw the creation of a new curriculum for elementary school students called Moose on the Loose. We will definitely talk about that this hour. Elizabeth, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Kenneth C. Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History and many other nonfiction books for adults and young adults. Ken will be speaking at an event hosted by the Historical Society tonight at 6. Check out our website for more information about that and links to Ken's work. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And Ken Davis, I haven't seen you in a long time. Good to have you back in the studio. Appreciate it.
It has been a while. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here again.
So, as I said, your book, Don't Know Much About History. How much don't we know, Ken? How bad is it?
It's really bad. And the trick is that it's been bad for a long time. This is not a new problem. In fact, when I wrote Don't Know Much About History 30 years ago, I hate to say it, it's been revised since then, this was being discussed as a problem certainly back then. But the Woodrow Wilson Foundation recently came out with more alarming statistics and said this is a problem that's been around for 100 years, because most of the time when people, and probably some of your listeners, hear the words civics, social studies, history, there's a long yawn. It's boring. It's dull. It's all those dates and battles and speeches. And history is anything but boring when we talk about it and really emphasize the connections between the past and the present. And this question has never been more important than it is right now.
So it's pretty bad right now. We don't know much about our own history. But you seem to be saying, Ken, we've never been great at this.
No, it's a long history that I think reflects in our very low rates of voter participation historically. You know, we think it's a great deal if 65% of people vote in a presidential election, and that's a high watermark. That's really on the low end of most modern industrial Western democracies. We don't vote, and it's not only sad, it's dangerous, obviously, because the Washington Post might say that democracy dies in darkness, but it doesn't. It dies in broad daylight, usually with millions of people cheering. So this is really not a question about memorizing facts to ace the Jeopardy, category of American history, but really understanding what the past has to do with the present, what our rights are, and what our responsibilities are. And that has been a longstanding problem, mostly because it has been pretty boring the way we taught it, dates and battles and speeches. History is about real people doing real things, and when we see it that way, it becomes a lot more alive, interesting, human, and we get a connection to the relevance in our own lives. And that's what I've tried to spend my career doing, is making history a lot more interesting than it was for most people in high school.
Well, and I must have had amazing history teachers, because I am fascinated by it. And you're right, though, if it's taught as dates and battles and speeches, you know, yawn, yawn, fill in the blank and move on. So, Elizabeth, what's your perspective on how much we Americans know and don't know?
I agree with Ken, absolutely. I mean, I think people know sort of the fortune cookie version of history. They know little dribs and drabs. Maybe they've seen something in a movie or on the History Channel, but they don't really understand the foundational principles behind a lot of this, I don't think. And I think they do need to understand the drama, the compelling human drama that's involved, but they also need to understand the bigger ideas that are behind, you know, our country and what it stood for and how it's developed and what challenges we've faced and whether or not we've overcome them. So I absolutely agree with Ken. I think kids are sort of the front line of this battle right now. And I think kids need to they need to have a better sense of their history.
And we'll talk in a few minutes about the new curriculum, Moose on the Loose, and how it attempts to address that, Elizabeth. But to you first, Ken, obviously I want you to jump in too. So why does this really matter? I mean, everyone has their interests. What if history is just not your thing?
Well, because I think particularly with history, I mean, you need that perspective to make good decisions, to understand, to put everything in context. So when someone tells you about, we're facing a terrible immigration crisis, well, you know, you might make a better decision if you understand that we've always had immigration crises. I mean, ever since the 18th century in New Hampshire, people may not have realized that in the 18th century, it was the tension between the English and the Scots-Irish that was so bad. Nowadays, we would find that laughable, that people would find Scots-Irish threatening. But at the time, it was very real to them, and they saw it as sort of a crisis of culture, that their own culture was going to be subsumed, the English's culture were going to be subsumed by the Scots-Irish. That same dynamic plays out over and over and over again. It did with the Irish and the French Canadians and the Italians and the Greeks and every other immigrant group that's come here. So if you know a little bit about that, then you're going to be able to keep our own challenges in perspective.
I couldn't agree more, and I would take it back even further. I've written about this, actually, that there was one of our founding fathers who was very worried about the immigrants who were coming into his colony then. It wasn't even a state. In the 1750s, he was worrying because their children didn't speak English, their street signs were in English, and he was really worrying, how are we going to keep our government if these people keep coming in, these hordes of people? And someone else at the same time said, yes, and they're sending their worst, in a sense. These are criminals and dangerous. They were talking about Germans in Pennsylvania, and this was Benjamin Franklin in the 1750s. Franklin eventually changed his views on that, as he did on a number of other important issues, including slavery, which is another aspect of this story that we haven't even touched on yet, but it's a very important one. So these are the real history that doesn't get in the school books too often, because we have presented this marbleized, very sanitized, whitewashed version for a long time. People did not talk about George Washington being a major slaveholder, and that was part of his whole life. One of my recent books is called In the Shadow of Liberty, and it's a hidden history of slavery and four presidents and five black lives. People who were owned and enslaved by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and that piece of our history is too important to ignore. It's a hard history, but we have to spend a lot more time teaching it, and that's one of the central issues I think we're all talking about here now, that history has really been pushed to the back burner in the current educational system. And it didn't happen 5 years ago, and it didn't happen 10 years ago. It certainly happened 25 years ago and has continued with things like No Child Left Behind and this rigorous concentration on standardized testing.
Well, couple points from what you just said, Ken. First of all, Elizabeth, do you agree that history has been pushed to the back burner for the last 15, 20, 25 years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it started in the 70s, and it's been accelerating since then, and I think we're really seeing the fruits of it now. But this has been a long process. I think it's kicked into high gear with No Child Left Behind. But I think we're really seeing the worst of it. And I think it's only going to get worse unless we do something to stop it.
So give us a little bit more there. It got kicked to the back burner in the 70s, and we're seeing the fruits now. What do you mean?
Well, there in the we don't have to go quite back that far to the 70s, yeah. But you did start to see an erosion of it as too controversial to discuss in schools in the 70s and the 80s and 90s. When 2001 rolled around and No Child Left Behind, all the standardized testing went to English language arts and math. Even science got kicked out. And you saw that for a while, teachers kept teaching it anyways, especially at the elementary levels. They kept teaching it because they had projects and units and they were used to it.
Well, and who doesn't like learning about the Revolutionary War?
Right,
it's fascinating.
Right, or your community and what your community did. But gradually, those teachers retired. The teachers coming in didn't have any background or preparation. In New Hampshire, they're not required. Elementary teachers are not required to demonstrate a competency in state history. And they weren't comfortable teaching it. They didn't have materials. They didn't have support. Their administrators would tell them, well, you really need to be focusing on the tested subjects. And so gradually, social studies fell out of practice. I mean, what we found is that in the elementary schools in New Hampshire, when we looked into this matter, is that many schools either don't teach it at all or teach just a little unit here and there, probably an average of, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes every 2 weeks. Usually the time for social studies, allotted for social studies, has to be shared with science. And science has done a much better job of creating materials, of training their teachers, of getting it in schools. And so the result has been social studies really has dropped out.
Well, and the push, at least for the last 10 years that I've heard, Ken, is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. But now in the last couple years, I'm hearing from businesses, we'd really like graduates who can think, reason, write, work in teams. So we seem to be sort of going around and around in a circle on this.
And we still have schools set up on a 19th century model where students were being prepared to go to the work in the factory, which was why bells rang and they were moved on to the next point. I think that some people would take this back even farther to the notion of when did social studies become what we learned, because it used to be separate subjects of history, civics, geography, and economics, generally the four rubrics that are in social studies now. And a lot of people will say, well, that's when it went down. And now we're talking about the 1930s, essentially. So this is a longstanding problem. And whatever social changes we've gone through, we've had textbooks that are written usually by professors or teachers to be read by other professors and teachers, textbooks that are then purchased by usually statewide school boards, sometimes local school boards, that really reflect the prejudices and the desires of those people to tell a story they want to be told. So we have a watered down, sanitized version of American history that is then presented in the most boring way possible, as opposed to. And so that's why the story goes back a long time. And so most people, when they think George Washington, what they really remember more likely is the cherry tree story, which was a complete fabrication, or that they heard that he had wooden teeth, which he did not have. He had actually teeth that were made from human teeth, and some of them he actually purchased from his enslaved people. That puts a different spin on George Washington's dentures, doesn't it? So when you bring that human factor in, I think it makes the history a lot more compelling. But we did have also in this country in 1957 what was called the Sputnik moment.
Yes.
The Soviets launched a satellite. We thought, they can't do it. This is this backwards country. They had the atomic bomb, and now they had a satellite. And it created such an enormous crisis in education that Congress actually responded with the first real national education bill in 1957. But a lot of people in the social studies field think that this is a Sputnik moment right now, that our inability to teach this subject, our inability to spend time teaching it and to focus on it and to talk about its importance is creating part of the crisis that we are seeing in democracy in this country.
Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today, we're looking at how history and social studies are taught in New Hampshire. And in a little bit later in the hour, we'll look at a new curriculum for elementary school students called Moose on the Loose. As always, we welcome your comments and questions about how you see history taught in our schools, especially at the lower grades. Our number 1-800-892-6477, our email exchange@nhpr.org. Something Ken said, I want to ask you, Elizabeth, do children still learn history through textbooks? Isn't everything online? So much new information is coming out. It seems kind of crazy to think that people would be using textbooks.
Yes. I mean, the textbook, though, they may not use a textbook as we would think of it, but the function, the idea behind the textbook is still very important, which is content. You have to learn the content somehow.
Sure,
but you just need to find more innovative ways of doing it.
Yeah.
Right. Which is part of the reason why the new curriculum is online, because when you print a textbook, you have to commit. When you do a website, you can update and change and tweak and revise. So you need to find different ways to present material. And one of the things that we heard from teachers all across the state was exactly what Ken said. So many of the classroom materials created for elementary students were not age appropriate. They were not set to the right reading level. They did not approach things as a third or fourth or fifth grader would look at them. And teachers found it just increasingly difficult to use them. And so this is one of the things that we have tried to address. The whole approach to teaching social studies has been outdated. And since 2010, the National Council for the Social Studies has tried to update it with some different pedagogical methods, different instructional methods. They've been very slow to be adopted in New Hampshire, in part because social studies has not been supported at the state level or at the district level. And so teachers don't even know about these new instructional methods and how dynamic and energizing it can be for their students to take a different approach.
Well, and I like your thoughts, Elizabeth, on what Ken said, that the history that a lot of us were taught was sort of a cherry tree version of history, a sort of whitewashed version. It doesn't mention, you know, anybody besides the sort of white guys leading the charge. But more recently, there have been some pushback to those efforts. People say, hey, this is revisionist history. You're downplaying our country's accomplishments and those who achieve them in the interest of promoting diversity and inclusion. I mean, how do you work through that, Elizabeth, the idea that, you know, revisionist history is the charge anyway?
Well, I mean, I think it is a very tough challenge. And in a state like New Hampshire, I think you have to be careful about not sort of falling into this trap of the same thing that applies to New Hampshire is not going to apply to a state like New York. We had different challenges than New York. We have different people who settled here. So sometimes there's a lot of emphasis on racial diversity in New Hampshire, which is great. We should talk about the fact that there were slaves in New Hampshire. But at the same time, New Hampshire's really, their big challenges have been ethnic diversity, because there's a lot of different ethnic groups in New Hampshire. And that diversity is just as valid as any other kind of diversity. So I think we do need to work it all in. A lot of this needs to be done at the high school level when kids are a little bit more able to make judgments like this. At the younger levels, younger grades, I think it's going to be a triumph just to get it in the schools. And I agree, you don't want whitewashed history, but you also want history that they can comprehend and manage and understand, which means initially it's going to be simple. And then as kids grow, it's going to be more and more developed and complex, which is exactly what you want them to do.
Well, and as we talk about diversity, the Exchange is planning a show later this month on how slavery is presented in schools, because that's a big topic. There's a big national conversation going on about that. So we'll get a New Hampshire take on that topic a little bit later this month. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Ken, how do you respond to this sort of charge that you're just engaging in revisionist history when you try to offer this more personal, broader, diverse perspective?
Well, I think that revisionist is this word that gets tossed around all the time, but my only interest is in accuracy. And as one of those founding fathers that we all admire said, John Adams, during a very notorious trial, facts are stubborn things. And we have to focus on facts. And I'll come back to the slavery question. In most school systems, it's been described as the hard history of slavery. It's not taught. It's an embarrassment. It is the stain on this idea of America as the birthplace of liberty and justice for all. What Lincoln called a nation conceived in liberty was also born in slavery. We are in the now marking these 400 years since the arrival of the first Africans who were sold into servitude in Jamestown in August 1619, just months after American democracy essentially was born with the House of Burgesses, as we were told as schoolchildren. The two things cannot be separated because slavery was part of everything that happened in this country for the next 400 years. And that's the only honest, factual way to approach that. The role of slavery in building the country, the role of slavery in the creation of the Constitution, the role of slavery in the Revolution itself are really significant issues that still reverberate down to our time. And when it comes to New Hampshire, I'll just point out that there's a wonderful, very human story about New Hampshire, that one of George Washington's enslaved people, a young woman named Ona Judge, ran away from the most powerful man in America while he was president in Philadelphia, got on a ship and sailed to New Hampshire. And Ona Judge lived out the rest of her life in New Hampshire. And it's a fabulous story. If we had a different perspective on things, we might have a statue to Ona Judge because she was standing up for her freedom. She died in relative poverty, but before she died, someone asked her if she did the right thing, and she said, yes, because I was free. So if we value these ideals of liberty and justice and freedom, then we have to understand what role that has played throughout our entire history, and not just in the cotton-growing South. Slavery existed in every one of the 13 colonies and the 13 states, and someone like Whipple was a slaveholder and a slave trader, and we have to acknowledge that.
Whipple was who, just real quickly, Ken?
He was one of the founders and a signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Okay. Well, and as I said, the exchange is going to be looking at this a little bit later this month because there's something called the 1619 Project, reflecting on those 400 years that you mentioned, Ken. So I will set it aside for now, but we're definitely going to be looking at that later. Also, coming up, we will look more at how history is taught at the youngest levels, and we'll take a closer look at the Moose on the Loose curriculum that our guest Elizabeth DeBrule is involved with. We'll find out how it addresses some of these issues: immigration, New Hampshire's connection to the natural world, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, modern history. All that's coming up, and we'll start taking your calls. So you can join us at 1-800-892-6477.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, have we undervalued the teaching of social studies and history in our schools? Our guests are both involved in this field and are backing a new history curriculum for elementary school students. We're finding out more, and we'd love to hear from you. Call 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Org. Kenneth C. Davis is with us today. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and many other books. He'll be speaking tonight at an event hosted by the New Hampshire Historical Society at 6. For more information and links, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Elizabeth DeBrule is also here, Director of Education for the Historical Society, and she oversaw a new curriculum that we're going to talk about called Moose on the Loose. It's a history curriculum for fourth graders. One more time, we welcome your comments. You can send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Evan, both of you, who says, at Harvard, almost every course has a textbook, often two or more, unless they are using research papers. Why should this be different in middle school or high school? Evan, thank you for the question. And we talked earlier, Elizabeth, I'll throw this to you, about textbooks. You guys, Ken, I think, talked about how the textbooks offer this sort of comfy, cozy, cherry tree version of history. And we talked about how quickly textbooks get outdated these days. What are your thoughts on that, Elizabeth, given Evan's email, on whether we should even use textbooks to teach history anymore?
Well, as I mentioned before, I mean, I think the content in textbooks must be taught. We must be teaching kids real information. But the method of delivery, I think we can do better than that. And I think if you consign yourself to textbooks, you're really kind of losing the battle to the other subjects, particularly science. I mean, science has done some really innovative things about the way they instruct kids and deliver material and explain concepts. There's no reason that social studies and history can't do the same. So, for example, there's a program that's used in the elementary schools called Mystery Science, where they pose a question and then they watch a short video about it to learn some background information. And then they do a bunch of activities to help them sort of come up with an answer. And then they make a presentation about their answer. It's a pretty simple concept, but it uses technology. It's engaging. Usually the question is compelling and interesting to kids. One of my favorite ones was, how do fish breathe? So you can learn all sorts of things from that. History and science and social studies could do the same thing that science is doing. And I think you're going to engage kids more. I think it's going to be a challenge to get kids to sit down and read textbooks today when they're used to reading things online and having educational experiences that are more engaging and interactive.
Well, and Ken, if the books were written 30 or 40 years ago, should they be used? Because as you have pointed out several times, those older textbooks, you know, for example, discussing the Civil War, North good, South bad, you know, and you mentioned earlier the history of slavery in New Hampshire. So I wonder what you think. Should we just chuck the textbooks?
Well, I am not an educational academic expert in any sense of the word. I only love to write and research and talk about history and share that with, especially in the past few years, directly with students and teachers. And I don't know of a teacher that I've met over the past 20 years of talking to teachers who says they like textbooks. So I don't know. I know about Harvard, and I know that they're probably not always the cutting edge of, you know, academic approach. So I'm not sure we want to stand to Harvard as our standard for what kids should be learning. I know a lot of teachers who would love to just ditch the textbook entirely and teach from, first of all, primary sources. It's the word that teachers talk about every day. And it's important not only in terms of history, but in terms of understanding media awareness and where our information comes from, because that's part of the conversation here as well. Social studies teaches us how to ask good questions and answer them.
Well, and the Moose on the Loose curriculum does use original documents, pictures of sort of artifacts, clothing, hats that people would have worn 100 or 200 years ago. So it's using those primary sources. And then you talk about where those articles or documents came from. And that's kind of setting the textbook aside and going straight to the source, Ken. I think that's what you're talking about there.
Absolutely talking about that, but also much more about teachers using trade books as opposed to textbooks. Trade books are the books you would find in a general interest bookstore. They're usually much more up to date. They're usually much more interestingly written than textbooks. So a lot of teachers are turning to that as a resource as well. And I would say that this is going down down to the very earliest age. And
you're
seeing
that. That's what we're working on with this new
curriculum. That's
what
you're also seeing in trade book publishing. There's been a real push in children's books for more diverse books, more diverse authors, more diverse subjects. So there are wonderful books for very young children on these subjects now.
Let's go to our listeners and see what they think. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email like Evan did. It's exchange@nhpr.org. And joining us on the line is Martha. Hi, Martha. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to thank you for having this conversation. And I want to applaud all the good work that's being done around the state, including the fourth grade curriculum that the New Hampshire Historical Society has worked really hard on the past few years. I wanted to add my perspective as the director of the Institute for Civics Education in New Hampshire and make sure I didn't hear the beginning of the conversation, so it may have been mentioned earlier, but our national social studies standards start with a question, and it's teaching through that arc of inquiry, research, which obviously teaches a lot of knowledge and facts in context, but also teaches things like media literacy, where you're evaluating sources. And then it ends with taking informed action, which is really teaching civic engagement. And it provides that sort of that more social-emotional skill of that sense that my voice matters, that I can make a difference. So I think we need all those components. We need knowledge, facts, history, media literacy, good questions, and then what do you do with all that to make your community better?
Well, Martha, thank you.
We've been training teachers for the past few years, and what we found is there's a ton of richness in the way that New Hampshire teachers are integrating and really being very innovative in the way that they are teaching it through either literacy or teaching civics and history, even through their classroom management system.
Well, Martha, I'm going to let our guests jump in if I could. And I like what she says, Elizabeth, about it starts with a question. There are a lot of questions on this new Moose on the Loose curriculum for fourth graders to teach them history. Lots of just good fundamental questions. Go ahead.
So the national standard that Martha referred to is was developed by the National Council for the Social Studies in 2010, and it is an inquiry arc. So you start with a compelling question, and the compelling question is supposed to be relevant, it's supposed to be provocative and engaging for students. And then you sort of flesh it out by looking at supporting questions. What do you need to know to answer the compelling question? And what research do you need to do? What facts can you gather and sources can you look at to answer those questions in a competent fashion? So then you put it all together into a fact-based argument, an evidence-supported argument, and you deliver it. You take informed action. And informed is really the key word there. Lots of people can take action. You want them to take informed action. So this is the new standard. It's basically called the C3 is the short version for it. It stands for college, career, and civic life. This is what New Hampshire is a little bit behind the times in. Other states, like New York, is one of the states that has really led the way in adopting the C3. But it allows you to look at questions. One of the questions on our site is, I think it's something along the lines of, are New Hampshire's forests a resource worth protecting? Well, that has currency. It's relevant to what's going on today, but you can learn more about history and civics and geography and economics and all those topics by really studying that question. So there's a bunch more that we'll be developing. There are all sorts of things around voting rights. That's really the hot ticket today. I think people take voting rights for granted, and they may not realize that they are fluid and they need to be protected. And those are the kind of, you know, so maybe the question would be something like, why should I vote or who should vote? Should people be guaranteed the right to vote? Can you lose the right to vote? So there's all sorts of this whole idea of inquiry-based education is really key on getting students to invest in what they're learning about and to see how relevant it is to today.
Martha, thank you for calling. And let's go next to Heidi in Norwich. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was
listening about the discussion about books and textbooks versus other methods. And when my daughter was in seventh grade, she was handed the book Night by Elie Wiesel to read about the Holocaust. And I was actually very shocked because I feel like that book is way over the top emotionally. It's a too tough a book to introduce at that age level for children. And what I ended up doing was I wrote a book about my mother's Holocaust experience. It's been named a notable social studies trade book by the National Council for Social Studies. It's specifically geared toward middle school, ages 10 and up. And it's starting to get used in some schools. I've developed a whole set of discussion questions. There's a lot of primary sources in the book and on my website. And I feel like genocide and it's such an important topic right now because of bigotry and hatred and prejudice and trying to fight that. And it starts with social studies. It starts with young kids.
And Heidi, do you want to give us the name of the book?
Sure. It's called Tutti's Promise. Tutti, which is my mother's nickname.
Okay.
And it's all based on things that really happened to her when she was liberated from a concentration camp just before her 10th birthday.
Okay. Wow. What a story. Thank you so much for calling in. And that sounds like, unlike a history, classic history textbook, which may or may not get outdated, that sounds, Ken, like a primary document, a narrative and a document of something that really happened that we need to know about.
Exactly the kind of thing I was talking about earlier when I said trade publishers are filling the gap and teachers want that stuff. They
right.
would much rather have a story of a real person, especially a young person. That's why the Diary of Anne Frank is, sells year in and year out, because teachers know this is a way to connect kids understanding this young girl's experience. And that's so important to our recognizing that history is a human story first and foremost. Just going back to the question issue again for a moment, because I'm not an academic and never studied teaching as a profession. But when I wrote a book about history, it was a book about questions. And I asked, who really discovered America and why is there a statue of Benedict Arnold's boot in Saratoga, New York? Because we all have questions. I mean, how do we begin teaching philosophy with the Socratic method? This is the most natural, perfect way to talk about history. And kids have questions. They are curious. They are interested. They are aware. They are far more sophisticated in many ways, and I question the callers, wondering if that book is age appropriate, because I think it certainly is. But this is a time when kids have more questions than ever. A lot of people have questions, and there's a lot of misinformation, and we haven't even touched on that yet. But part of my passion for this recently has emerged from the fact that last year, I'm a student myself now. I went back to college at night, and I was in a classroom on the night before election day, and someone said they weren't going to bother to vote because it didn't matter because of that electoral college thing. I mean, of course, this was an off-year election. So the teacher in the class, knowing who I was, asked me to talk about it a little bit, and that's when it really hit me that this is a much bigger conversation, that people really do not understand their rights, their responsibilities, and the tremendous sacrifices that went into giving us the right to vote, and that's part of what history is.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Couple emails from our listeners that I'd like to share with you. Someone wrote, this is an interesting story for a retired history teacher. I was fortunate to have many supplemental resources students read weekly, including, don't know much about history, so there you go, Ken. This person says, I loved storytelling, teaching ongoing themes, and recognizing that everything we do is history. Thank you so much for that note from that person. And this gets to something you just said, Ken, and that you mentioned earlier, Elizabeth, and I'll turn to you first, Elizabeth. You said voting rights are a hot ticket right now, and that is certainly part of our history. How do educators get into this, again, with young kids we're talking about, without putting their own political spin on it?
It is challenging, and you have to be very careful. And I've been at workshops, teacher workshops, that have talked about sort of these hot button controversial issues, and teachers have said, this is all wonderful, but how can I teach this without getting fired? So it is a concern. When we have a unit on the New Hampshire presidential primary in the new curriculum, and we took the approach that instead of trying to like give a blow by blow of the development of the New Hampshire primary, we said, let's just focus on the traditions. And ultimately, the tradition, the single biggest tradition, is this idea that New Hampshire voters, your responsibility is to be open minded and to listen to the candidates and to get informed on the candidates and not listen to the media or the party or anybody else.
Wait, not listen to the media. Hold on.
So that was sort of what we focus on. How do the traditions of the New Hampshire primary, like visiting diners and Roby's Country Store, how do those things key into this idea that New Hampshire voters are going to make up their own minds? They're not going to be told what candidates to think. And in the end, we sometimes really shake up the presidential election because we do just that.
So the curriculum you developed, Moose on the Loose, is, as we've been saying all hour, focused more on the younger kids. But
yes.
I wonder what your thoughts are, though, at the older levels, middle school, high school, teaching about voting rights and the struggle for voting rights in this country without, again, putting that contemporary spin on it. Or maybe you're supposed to put that contemporary spin on it. I don't know.
Well, I think one of the other advantages of teaching with history is that you can teach the history of a controversial topic, and it isn't quite so poignant as what's going on right now, but it still has relevance. So in other words, when you talk about what was the struggle to get the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed, you can talk about all these same issues that we're dealing with today about who should vote, how should you exercise that right, should there be limits on it, but you're doing it from a little bit of a remove by talking about it in history. And yet it isn't very hard at the end to make those connections to what's happening today. And it gives you, again, that little bit of perspective, a little bit of distance to maybe look at a subject without you want to be personally invested, but you don't want to feel angry or anxious about it. You want to be able to learn about it and then maybe apply to those lessons to what's happening today.
That's really interesting. Kim, what do you think?
Well, a couple of points. First of all, I think this goes back to what we've been focusing on, coding. Coding is important, but voting is really important. But it's not just voting, too. I know that a lot of schools focus on getting their students to register. But one of the stories of history is that most of the change in this country past has come from the ground up and not always at the ballot box. From abolition to suffrage to the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and in many of those cases, they were led by people who couldn't vote.
Young people.
And the
or
best,
women.
The
or...
best way to teach the history of voting rights is not with a textbook, but might be with the graphic novel March, the story of John Lewis. And a lot of teachers are really loving that approach.
Okay. We will talk a lot more after a short break. You can join us as well with an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, new ideas around teaching history and social studies in our schools and whether these subjects have been undervalued in American culture. Let's hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477. How were you taught history and how do you think the teaching of history could be improved, especially at the younger grade levels? You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests in studio, Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About History book and many others in that Don't Know Much About series. Davis will be speaking at an event hosted by the New Hampshire Historical Society tonight at 6. More information is on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Also with us, Elizabeth DeBrule, Director of Education for the Historical Society. She oversaw the creation of the new Moose on the Loose curriculum aimed at elementary school students, especially fourth graders, concerning U.S. history and New Hampshire history. And Elizabeth, I'd like to ask you about that right now. So how did this come about, this new history curriculum that you're unveiling this week?
Well, the New Hampshire Historical Society has been providing educational programming since 1964, and we get about 10,000 New Hampshire school kids a year participating in our program. So we have a long history, a pretty wide pool to draw from. We noticed a few years ago a real decline, and it was pretty sudden, to be honest, in what kids knew, what they were bringing with them when they came to our programs. And
it actually
required us to reshape some of our programs because the kids just didn't have the background knowledge to make them work anymore.
So, and pardon me for interrupting, so you and Ken both said earlier that for a long time, Americans have not had a robust understanding or appreciation of their history, but you noticed a drop off just in recent years.
Yeah, I do. And as I said before, I think this is all that's come before is really coming to fruition now. We're really seeing the rubber hit the road at this point. So we noticed a decline, I would say, around 2013 or 2014. And so we started, it sort of launched us on this big exploration. We started really talking to everybody we could talk to, from superintendents to curriculum coordinators and teachers and nonprofit groups and the Department of Education and legislators. And what we found was very disturbing, that social studies had pretty much dropped out of elementary schools altogether, that even in the middle schools in New Hampshire, it's been eroded. Some schools no longer consider it one of the core subjects. So now it's down to just three core subjects, and social studies is sort of in the realm with art and music. And high school teachers were telling us they were having to start their own instruction at a more remedial level because for a lot of their kiddos, they were just being introduced to this stuff for the first time. So we really focus our efforts at the elementary level. We thought that was where the crisis was the worst. It was also where they traditionally do state history, which is, you know, our backyard. And we realized once we did a listening tour and talked to teachers, there were a number of areas where they could use support. One of them was creating more curricular resources. They didn't have age-appropriate resources, reading-level appropriate resources to teach state history. So we created this website, this curriculum, Moose on the Loose, Social Studies for Granite State Kids, that addresses all these sort of issues. It teaches state history, economics, civics, geography. It provides overviews and training in social studies methods because teachers aren't learning social studies methods in their teacher preparatory programs anymore, so they can't help their kids work with primary sources. We found there's almost no professional development for teachers in elementary social studies in the state. There's very little, so we wanted to help with that. And we also wanted to just become a more vocal advocate at every level, that social studies has been marginalized and it needs to be addressed. We've had a wonderful response. Everyone wants to teach social studies. The schools want to teach it. They just don't have time or resources or support to do so. And so we're trying to sort of fill that gap, particularly at the elementary level.
That's interesting. So you and Ken both earlier talked about how you feel social studies has been marginalized, but especially, it sounds like, Elizabeth, at the elementary level.
Yes.
So that's the gap you were trying to fill.
Yes. But districts in general need to do a social studies audit. I mean, districts haven't really looked at their social studies programs for more than a decade in most cases. So we've found a lot of districts who maybe they taught, they had individual units, maybe they taught Jamestown three times, but they didn't teach anything else. Or they hadn't vertically aligned their curriculum so that it made sense, there was a sequence that made sense to what they taught. A lot of schools still do not spiral their curriculums, which basically means they start what little social studies they give in elementary school. They start at the colonial period. They work through up to the high school. By the time you get to high school, you're in modern U.S. history. But you've never gone back and had a more sophisticated understanding of the American Revolution than what you might have gotten in fifth grade. So no other subjects are taught this way. I mean, could you imagine if they taught chemistry this way? Well, we're not going to talk about the gaseous elements because you learned about them in second grade. that's like one of the things that they need to, some of the things that the districts need to do to stop marginalizing social studies.
Let's take another call. This is Helen in Wanalancet. Hi, Helen. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm a veteran teacher, 50 years, and interestingly enough, I was a chemistry teacher. But I want to say, in the pre-Sputnik, post-Sputnik, I made $2,000 a year my first year. And so God bless all into it, because it isn't for the money and it isn't for the prestige. I will say that back in those days, we were worried about people not getting enough science, and the post-Sputnik era was very Socrates-oriented. We engaged people with some kind of a hook, and it made them think like crazy. We drove them crazy. And science was not getting the emphasis, and people weren't comfortable teaching science. Now they've gone the other way, and yes, we need kids to know why it's such a privilege to vote, among many other things. But I will say, it depends on the teacher themselves. You can't make a person, the teachers are people, do something that is completely antithetical to them. And one of the things we do to teachers is ask them to change directions, sometimes more than once a year in some major way. And no one can do that without significant cost to their pound of flesh. And so, support them.
Helen, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Ken.
A couple of things there. First of all, many people don't understand. They think that we have some, because we have a Department of Education, that we have some federal standards. That's not the case. Education is really a statewide, left up to the states. That's why New Hampshire can do what it wants to do, and New York and Minnesota. But teachers in every state say the same thing to me, that social studies is not considered a core anymore, which was an astonishing idea when I heard it for the first time, because what is more important than understanding history, as far as I'm concerned? The second point is the question about teachers being ill-prepared is one we haven't really talked. Because there has been, in the past 20 years, this focus on teaching science, that's what teachers are being taught to teach. And many teachers are coming out of teaching programs unprepared to teach history. So the problems are compounding themselves. And lastly, and I would just say to her point about paying teachers, we have seen teachers take to the streets, certainly for their salaries, but more importantly, they're talking about improving conditions for their students, the materials, the textbooks, the amount of time, what's being taught. Teachers are absolutely, in my experience, devoted to being teachers. They could probably make more clerking at Banana Republic, but they choose to teach because they love it, and it's a profession and it's a calling. So I worship teachers and thank the one who just called, and we have to really value teaching much more than we do.
Well, and we talked earlier about your concerns that many people, not just children, are, to quote from your speech that you're going to give tonight, Ken, awash in misinformation and lies from electronic media. How does Moose on the Loose, Elizabeth, approach the idea of teaching historical literacy, digital literacy, whatever you want to call it, sort of helping young students, because this is aimed at fourth graders, to discern what might be true and what isn't?
Well, I mean, it is challenging with this age group, and we always try and keep that in mind about what is age appropriate. But there are things you can do to teach digital literacy and media literacy. And the part of the English language arts standards, the national standard, is discerning the difference between fact and opinion and recognizing bias in what people are writing. So, I mean, that's all worked into lesson plans that are in the Moose on the Loose curriculum about how do you evaluate an ad? How do you judge an ad? How do you bring what you know to what you're looking at? And does it make sense? Some of the things that might be tip-offs that you need to look at this more. One of the things that we always emphasize is that you must look at more than one source. You must look at multiple sources to start to get at the truth, and from different perspectives. It isn't just about one person's perspective. So I think kids are receptive to that. Kids can understand that. And they are, if anything, kids are savvy about advertisers. You know, they've been getting it on TV since they were tiny. So they know when people are trying to sell something and that they might not necessarily be truthful. And so I think that you can do quite a bit with political advertising and how that has played out.
Helen, thank you for the call. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. couple more emails I'd like to share with you. Patrick says, I'm curious to hear if the guests are familiar with the National History Day in New Hampshire program. It's part of a national project-based curriculum that encourages students to investigate a topic of their choice relating to a theme. Patrick, thank you for the email. I had not heard of this.
It's a wonderful program. It's run out of Plymouth State. It's absolutely phenomenal. Kids work on projects all year, and they can develop them in all sorts of media, different types of media. So they can develop a performance, they can develop an exhibit, they can write a paper, they can do a website, they can make a documentary film. They have a big statewide competition every April. We would love to see more people participate in National History Day. Again, this is something that not as many New Hampshire students or teachers know about as really should, but it's a wonderful, wonderful program.
Well, we got an email from Chris. She's a senior at Plymouth State. She was homeschooled through middle school, and she says, I'm always shocked by the attitude people in my classes have toward history in general. There's this perception that history is a study of dates and battles and subjective facts, so the study of history is useless in their view. Chris says, I spent my childhood devouring historical fiction, which has given me a deep love for history. I don't know where this distaste for historical education has come from and why there seems to be mainstream agreement to hate it. Chris, I completely understand. And as I said earlier, Ken, I must have had fabulous history teachers because I am fascinated by history.
And that is often the key, or just having the good luck that your father was a guy who wanted to take you on camping trips when you were a kid and you went to places like Gettysburg and Valley Forge and Fort Ticonderoga, which is what I did. And I got from the time I was 5 years old the sense that history isn't something that happens in books. It happens to real people in real places, and we have to teach it that way. We also have to show the connections of history across subjects, and I wish we had time to talk about like the flu, the Spanish flu, and World War I. Most people never put them together. They were inseparable. The worst pandemic in modern history and the worst war of the beginning of the 20th century were inseparable. I've seen teachers take this subject and do wonders with it with their kids, and the kids are really fascinated because they're talking about the flu and not just the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah, well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I'd like to refer listeners to our show last week on what Downton Abbey can teach us about that period of time, including 1919, the Spanish flu. And it's fascinating what a good job those producers did connecting these gorgeous characters and their beautiful clothes with these real live events. So I'm glad you mentioned that, Ken. And it was really great to see both of you. Good luck with your speech tonight, Ken. There's a link on our website to that event. Thank you both very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.